Hi, everybody. I'm Justin. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's July 28th, 2003, and I have a home group and a sponsor, and I'm glad to be here tonight. Thanks, Billy, for inviting me out, and I dragged out a good friend of mine, Eric, who spoke here, about a month ago? And I said, going to Blue Ridge, I need somebody to come with me. And I think he felt guilty, so he's out here. But I'm glad you came out with me today, and we had a great dinner. In lieu of pig and steak, we went to the local McDonald's, and we got the same thing, a quarter pounder with cheese and a 10-piece McNugget, so I'm feeling full, and which is better than, you know, it's better than me being halting and needing food, because I'm a nightmare when I don't have enough food. Anyway, so I digress a little bit. Definitely an alcoholic. I drink for the effect produced by alcohol, like the book talks about. And, you know, I was born and raised in Richmond. That's where my mother still lives, my stepdad, and, you know, born to a good family. You know, it's funny, I talk about it that I think most families nowadays, there's some sort of dysfunctional aspect to just about any family, so I don't think there's any classic family still out there necessarily. There's always something weird going on, and, you know, I'm no exception to that necessarily. You know, I had a brother who was about a year and a half older than I was, and he had a liver disease when he was born, and he ended up at the age of five, he ended up getting a transplant, and this was back in the late 80s, and his body ended up rejecting the liver after the transplant, and so my brother passed away at 5 years old, and I was about three and a half when it happened, and so the reason I mention that is because it, you know, it's actually prevalent in my story in some ways. It does not make me an alcoholic. None of the circumstances of how I was raised make me an alcoholic. You know, I think I just used them as leverage in a lot of cases when I wanted to get my way. But my brother passed away, and the reason I mention that partially is because that really affected my parents. Anybody that has lost a child probably understands. Like, I think they blamed each other, you know, for a lot of this stuff, and you know, we could have done stuff differently or whatever it may be. They had a hard time reconciling that aspect of their life, and so my parents split when I was 7 years old, and my dad was involved in politics, so he went up to where politics happens in D.C., or where it doesn't happen, however you want to look at it. You know, so he went up to D.C., and I stayed with my mom in Richmond. My dad said when he left, he said, "Justin, now you're the man of the house." And I didn't take this as, you know, now I'm going to have more responsibility. I'm going to do chores more. I'm going to show up more for my mom and be there, be a rock in her life. I did not see that. I didn't look at it that way at all. The way I looked at it was, I'm going to get whatever I want. No questions, you know. And at 7 years old, you know, I want a new starter jacket, you know. I want a new pair of Jordans. I want like anything that seemed like a fad, or anything that I came to mind, you know, watching Nickelodeon or whatever. I mean, the marketers got me. They were the ones that were trying to get me to buy whatever they, you know. So, and I started to milk this idea of, you know, dad left, you know, and this false resentment that I would carry throughout my drinking about my parents and the situation. That I mean, I never wanted for anything as a kid, you know, but I sure as heck would act like I wanted for a lot, and that I was given the you know, bad deal or whatever, you know. I mean, I really tried to play upon this idea that, you know, my parents had really screwed me over. and I used it to my advantage as much as I could. So as time kind of progressed, we were living in the city of Richmond, and I, you know, my mom decided that was a good idea in the fifth grade that we move out to the suburbs in hopes that, you know, I'd get a better chance of better education. The public schools are a little bit better out in, you know, the suburbs and in the west end of Richmond. You know, so she was expecting that things were going to just have a good opportunity. And what she didn't realize was, one, I was ready for a drink by the time the fifth grade rolled around. And I, you know, I'd been in Catholic school growing up, you know, and I was mama's boy. I needed a little edge in my life. And so what happened was I gravitated, you know, in the fifth grade, I gravitated towards the skateboarders. Because the skateboarders had a little bit of an edge to them, you know, and so I started wearing Airwalks and, you know, trying to be cool. And I wasn't a skateboarder, but I'd rip my shoes just to make myself look like a good skateboarder. And, you know, I was just, everything in my life was, you know, gravitating towards the idea that I needed something because I didn't feel okay. And you'll hear this probably a lot in AA. You know, I either felt, and this is the case in my case, I either felt less than people or I felt much better than people. And that was my case all the time. And so got through fifth grade, ended up in middle school, and just kind of preface a little bit of this. I got sober at 19 years old. So I was super young coming in AA. And prior to that, I'd been in a long-term treatment facility for 2.5 years. So I know everybody always does that. He was in it for just about the same amount of time, maybe a little less. So most of my drinking, I never had a legal drink. Now, you'll hear my story as I progress a little bit. That doesn't mean much because I made a lot of problems in my life and I created a lot of difficulties for my family, so on and so forth. So middle school came around and I started experimenting, you know. And the experimenting kind of phase of drinking, I mean, my mom's a drinker. You know, I grew up in the South. My grandfather was a drinker to the day he died. Grandmother, too. They drank bourbon and water, which is just watered-down bourbon, you know, and smoked Virginia Slims. I mean, it was the way it was. Drinking in my family seemed just normal. It just seemed like a part of life. It didn't seem like it was a – I mean, most of my family probably had problems with alcohol, but – you would never thought it because everybody was constantly. It was funny. I was at a. We do this. We've started doing this like a family Christmas party for my mom's side of the family. We were watching it a couple years ago, and they had these old home videos from Christmas time. And you're watching everybody, and it's weird. Everybody's got a cigarette in one hand and a drink in the other, and they're unwrapping Christmas presents seamlessly. It was unbelievable how well they were able to do that. But it was just normal. This part of my life was normal growing up. So when it came time for me to try alcohol, it seemed easy. You know, in the beginning, I was hanging out with the McGuire boys. They're the Irish family, you know, in my neighborhood. Good kids. If I had ended up hanging out with the McGuire boys my entire, you know, drinking career, if you will, I probably wouldn't need to be in AA. They were good kids, good family, and they just experimented. If I had continued to hang out with them, I probably would have just drank at homecoming games, and that would have been it. And I would have maybe gotten good grades. I don't know. But that was only the beginning of my drinking, you know, and the beginning of my drinking was more, I mean, they would get some Coronas, hide them in a shoebox, and we'd drink hot Coronas in the woods, you know, just to, you know, get our beak wet a little bit on the on drinking, and that was really it. And then at some point, I started to gravitate, you know, we talk about finding lower companions, and I started gravitating towards people that were not like my mom would call them unsavory characters. She called a lot of my friends became Eddie Haskell to my mom, and most people probably can catch that reference. But she, you know, a lot of my friends were just bad kids, and so I started hanging out with this new group of friends, and I didn't realize for a number of years where I was hanging out, but I was hanging out in the local crack house. And didn't even realize it. This family that I was hanging out over their house, the mother didn't care who was in and out of the house. She didn't care if he smoked in the house, which for a 13, 14-year-old, it's like that's gold right there. If you can smoke in somebody's house and mom doesn't care, it is amazing. And it was a single-family home. So there's multiple rooms, probably five bedrooms. None of the bedrooms were predetermined to be anybody's necessarily. They were just bedrooms. And so you could get drunk, you could do whatever in any room in the house. It was, you know, behind this door, you know, I mean, it was like that. So I kind of fell in love with it coming over to this, you know, this guy's house. And so there's always something going on. And never any food. If you're going there to try to get, like, Hot Pockets or something like that, you're not getting any food. It was just bread, and I think they had milk and tap water. So you had to be okay with those main things. You know, if you were looking to, if you got the munchies, you couldn't rely on that house for anything like that. And the mom was dating a guy who looked like Gandalf from Lord of the Rings, drove a conversion van with airbrushed, I mean, the whole kit and caboodle, had it done right. And they were raising a half wolf in the backyard. So hopefully this paints a little picture of what this place was like. And I remember I was sitting in this one room and, you know, stuff was getting passed around. And it was like a light switch. And I said, I want to start drinking as much as I possibly can. And I don't care what the stakes are. And that moment, I remember. I mean, usually moments, you don't remember moments quite like that, but it was so pivotal because the change that happened from hanging out with the McGuire boys, the homecoming game, to I'm going to start doing this as much as possible. That change happened almost instantaneously. And my whole motivation for life seemed to be to drink. And Once your motivations at 14 years old become nonstop drinking and partying as much as you possibly can. In my case, it was, I mean, everything went out the window. My mediocre, you know, school skills out the window. I just became like almost non-existent at school. I remember my mom said to me one time, she said, Justin, I don't care what you do at school. She said, I don't care if you get good grades. I don't care anything. Just go. And I couldn't even do that. And so my drinking started to progress. My mom would freak. She was working for the Attorney General in Richmond. And she would frequently get phone calls from the school. Mrs. Watson, your son is running across the baseball field as we speak. Or she'd get a call from one of the subdivisions, a neighbor from one of the subdivisions behind the school. Mrs. Watson, I think I found your son's backpack in the creek behind our house with all his books in them, you know. And there are some unique identifiers to my book bag that she had to ask. Well, what does this book bag look like? Well, it's got marijuana plants and whiteout all over the backpack. Oh, that's my son's backpack. You know, so I was not going anywhere fast. And life was not, getting better. It was getting worse. But if you ask me, and the book talks about this, basically the alcohol to their life is the only normal one. I believe that because if you had asked me, you know, in this time, Justin, how's your life going? I said, my life is fantastic. If people would just leave me alone and let me drink the way that I want to drink, I'll be good. The problem is that nobody that loves and cares about me nobody that loved and cared about me, was letting me off the hook for my drinking. You know, everybody was concerned, scared. They didn't know how to handle me. And, you know, things just progressively got worse. You know, I pushed my mom out of the way one time trying to get money out of her purse. And she called the police. And this became a common occurrence in Crown Grant subdivision, which was not like a... It was a very rare thing to see a police car in this neighborhood, or an ambulance, or a fire department. Not when I was living there. It was pretty frequent that you'd see first responders at the house. You know, I pushed my mom out of the way, stole money out of her purse, and she called the police, and I got put on probation. And my dad knew some juvenile judges through his years in politics and figured out ways to put the restraints on me as much as he could, without getting me into the system necessarily, which I'm grateful for. I mean, that was certainly helpful, in a lot of ways. But really, my parents tried to modify my behavior. That's really what it comes down to, and I think anybody close in our lives and our drinking likely wants to modify our behavior. If they'd only stop drinking, you'll be much better off, you know. But what they didn't understand is the sense of ease and comfort that I got from drinking always outweighed the consequences for it. And so that's to say, I would do just about anything without regard. I didn't care what the consequences were, because that sense of ease and comfort always outweighed it, always. And so I continued this route, and again, my parents continued to try to modify the behavior. And so eventually I got put in, there's some military schools in the area. I got sent to Fork Union first, and that didn't end well. It was weird. I got some drugs from somebody or something like that. I don't remember exactly what happened. But somebody thought I was a narc at the military school, and I was like, I am not going back to this place. There's no way I'm doing that. And my mom tried to take me back, and I remember this was an awful experience. I remember we had picked up some cheeseburgers before we were going back to this military school that I didn't want to go back to. And we get about 2 miles out from this military school, and I start losing it. And I start throwing this cheeseburger at the window in the car, inside the car. I'm just losing my mind because I don't want to go back to this military school. It was awful. And then I just opened the door and got out and just started walking in the opposite direction. And luckily that was the ticket out of military school. You just throw a cheeseburger, you can get out of that. That was my experience in that situation. Needless to say, my parents needed me to be in more of a controlled environment because of just how awful I'd been. And so they sent me to another military school, Fishburne, in Waynesboro, which I don't know if it's even still there. But I got sent there, and they sent me for the summer school version of it. And I was one of the lucky 9 out of 250 cadets that was chosen for the random drug test. And no chance that I was going to pass that drug test. No chance. And sure enough, I didn't. And I went back to... they kicked me out, and my dad took me back, and I moved up to D.C. for the rest of that summer. And under the idea that I get counseling to help with my drug problems or whatever they thought I had. And I did that, and I went back for the next semester. And I kind of realized that I couldn't, you know, I can't do things that I'm going to get tested for, because then I might get kicked out again. So I had to be careful about how I approach this thing to get outside of my head, because, you know, that's my main thing, is I'm trapped inside of my body and I have alcoholism. And if you're sober, and this goes back to why it's not an alcohol problem, you know, when I'm sober, I feel awful. I feel restless, irritable, and discontented, you know, so I had to start to figure out like a couple ways to get around these drug tests, and drinking was an obvious. I mean, that was an easy one. You know, you're not going to get drug tested for drinking. I guess you get breathalyzed, but anyway. So bottom line is my drinking started picking up when I could, which was a little difficult still because I was in a military school. And I was prescribed Ritalin because I'm AD whatever, or at least they thought I was. Everybody was at one point in time. And so instead of taking it, I just snorted it. And I did that for the entire time. But that I started to figure out, and I think, you know, and I mention this stuff because, not to say, I mean, alcohol is the big show. Okay, alcohol was always the constant. I'm alcoholic. But you hear in some of the big book, you know, using high-powered sedatives, and that's what these things did for me. It helped me get through times when I couldn't have alcohol, and it also Ritalin helped you drink a lot more, you know, and I could get it when I was on some Ritalin. So anyway, I did that for a bit of time while I was in military school, and in the summer, and I got through an entire year. I don't know how I got through the entire year, but I did. And by the time I got out of there for summer school, I was ready to drink. I mean, I went home for Thanksgiving, and I remember I drank like a fish. But by the time I got out of that first year, I was ready for a drink. And that summer, I drank like it was nobody's business. And, you know, by this time, I had figured out a couple things. My mom, she's an enabler. I'll say that. I don't even like that word necessarily, but she is. And I think she just loves me. And she wants me to be happy more than anything. And I think she had probably a little bit of guilt from, you know, what happened to my brother. I don't know, whatever. Bottom line is, you know, and I use that to my advantage throughout my drinking. So I remember it started, I said, you know, I would steal cigarettes. And I said, and my mom found out that I was stealing cigarettes and smoking. And I said, Mom, why don't you just buy me cigarettes? I said, it's easier. And the truth is that you know, I won't get caught for stealing. You won't have to worry about that. So just buy me cigarettes. It'll be fine. And she started buying me cigarettes. So that was kind of the first notch of, you know, this thing. And then I came back from military school from year two or year one. And I just come back from a Wailers concert without Bob Marley, but it was a Wailers concert, and a buddy of mine was with me, and we were going upstairs, and he took off his hat, and he had a thing of weed under the bill of the hat that came out on the step, and my mom saw it, and I was like, oh. I was like, this is not good. My mom's like, what's that? And got caught for it, yada yada yada. And my mom has a new boyfriend who likes smoking weed. And by the end of the night, I'd sold my mom some weed and because her boyfriend wanted it or whatever. And she had been hiding the liquor. And I figured out that she had a bottle of Aristocrat out in the shed. So I'm sitting here drinking with my mom, you know. And it's a Saturday night. And I knew at that moment, now I'm going to get what I want. 100%. Now it's hard to turn back from this at this point. Like we set a precedence, and so from that point, during that summer, I figured out a way, just like I did with the cigarettes. I said, Mom, I'm going to steal alcohol. Just buy it for me, and it'll make life easier. And throughout that summer, I mean, talk about increase in drinking. And I'd say to my mom before she came home from work, I'd say, Mom, can you stop at you know, the ABC store and pick me up a half gallon of Aristocrat. And get that lemon type. The lemon type is a little bit better than the normal Aristocrat, the original flavor. and then in the morning sometimes, before she went to work, I'd ask her to stop at the food line and pick up a 2 12-packs of beer in the bottles. And as a drinker, as a 16-year-old alcoholic, I have literally just hit the jackpot. This is the best, absolute best circumstances. It's summertime. I'm not in military school right now. I'm getting alcohol as much as I want it. I don't have to worry about hiding it. This is perfect. What I didn't realize is that I was literally, what I'd done is broken down the mother-son kind of relationship 100%, you know. And through that summer, I began asking my mom, like, I one time proposed to her the idea of getting a kegerator for the house and putting a keg in the house and having beer on tap. And I said, Mom, it just makes sense. I mean, seriously, financially, this is just a better thing. You won't have to go out to the store all the time. You know, we're gonna have beer on tap. It's gonna be great. You know, crazy. And so I was out of control. I mean, things were not good. And I'm at this point, I'm 300 pounds because if you drink constantly and eat constantly, it happens. And it's funny because when I got into AA, I was like, I don't see how alcohol affected me physically. You know, I totally didn't even think about it, you know, but I realize now that it did. And so I'm going back into military school for year two. And before I go back, I know that now I'm not going to have the constant stream of alcohol that I was used to having. And so my mother ended up, I remember vividly, I was standing in, or I walked into the house and she was in the kitchen and she was filling up Deer Park water bottles with vodka so that I could take them back with me to military school. Because she knew that it was going to be a problem. And I remember that now, and it's kind of heartbreaking now, you know, the fact that she had to do that or felt the need to do that, or I'd put her to a point where she felt the need to do that. And so, you know, but at the time I was like, this is a great idea. You know, this is a great idea. And I went back to military school for a year or two, And almost immediately got kicked out again. This time for Ritalin. God, Ritalin. It's the worst. Got kicked out because I was trading Ritalin with other kids for cigarettes. You know, it's like a barter system. And so, you know, when this happened, I mean, I'm a liability to the military school at this point. And when this happened, $17,000 flushed down the toilet. In my mind, didn't even faze me. You know, I thought, thank God, now I can get out of this hellhole and I can go back to drinking the way that I want to drink. And for the next 3 months, what happened was, is I drank nonstop, you know, all the time. And this is where I can start to see the real powerlessness of my alcoholism. I'd wake up in the morning and inevitably from drinking all night the night before, wake up in the morning or come to in the morning, and I've got the worst hangover ever. And I get up out of bed, wake and bake, because that seems like the only way to deal with a hangover like that. Get some food inside of me, start drinking again. You know, and then do that all through the rest of the day, to the evening, to late at night, and to the next morning. And then I'd turn on, they had a 50s station, and I'd turn on the 50s music to kind of soothe my mind a little bit, to pass out, and then I'm out. And I literally did that every day for the next 3 months. And I didn't know, there were a couple things happening in the background that I was unaware of. My dad, he would constantly get phone calls where he'd have to make the trek down from D.C. to Richmond to, you know, get into a fight with me or something like that, you know, and we were constantly at odds, constantly getting the, Bobby, I don't know how to handle this kid, you know, he's acting crazy again, you know. These phone calls were constant. And my stepmother said, you know, she wasn't my stepmother at the time. She was, you know, engaged to my father. She said, "Bobby, if you don't get your son help, I'm not going to marry you." And so, needless to say, I pushed my dad into high gear. And here's how God works. So my stepmother had some mutual family friends with Eric's grandparents. Okay? Follow this. So Eric's grandparents had told that mutual family friend how great Eric had done at this long-term treatment facility in New York State, up in the Catskill Mountains in New York State. And they explained how he was when he was out there drinking and whatever. And they said, "Oh, that's exactly the way Justin is." And they said, "Yeah, Eric has done really, really well. And, you know, you should look at this place." Literally within maybe a week, my dad's on his way up to Hancock, New York. And he's checking out this place, figures out that it's just the place for me. It's one of these places that you can't get kicked out of, you know. And I was a pro at getting kicked out of places. But this is a place meant for people just like me. And so I went. It was Thanksgiving time. Wow, I didn't even think about this. November 30th of 2000 when I got sent to this place. That's crazy. So I remember it was Thanksgiving, and my dad took me to a Redskins game. And I remember him saying to me, "Justin, do you want to come live with me?" And I said no. I said, "I want to be back home in Richmond. That's where, you know, that's, I knew everything there. I knew where everything was at." And he said, "Okay." He said, and when I was leaving, I would take the train usually back down to Richmond. He said, "You know those hiking boots?" He's like, "Why don't you take those hiking boots with you when you go home?" And I said, "Okay, whatever." Didn't think anything of it. I got home and my mom said, "You know, Justin, I think you need a new winter jacket." And I said, "Okay, cool. Let's go to Marshall's." And went, got a new winter jacket. And then like 3 days later, I got woken up by escorts. Not the fun type. There were two off-duty police officers that were like, that said I was going to this long-term treatment facility in New York State, with whether I liked it or not, I was going to this place. And the night before, I had been drinking Milwaukee's Best. You know, I mean, there was nothing. There was no knowledge of what was happening, or, you know, preparation, nothing. And I remember going up to this place and just feeling defeated, but not really knowing what that feeling was. But it was almost like the jig is up, you know. My time is over in this game. You know, that's kind of, without even knowing that was what was happening, that was what was happening. And so I got to this place and promptly found out that this guy was the reason I got sent there. And needless to say, I didn't like the name Eric for a long time. Into this treatment facility, because he was the reason I was locked up. That's how I felt, you know. And so I you know, when I got to this place, I didn't want to stop drinking. Like I said, I've been drinking the night before, and by the time I left, and this I think is the essential, you know, I don't think treatment facilities get you sober, or I don't think they're, you know, what keeps somebody sober. I think AA is, but I think they're essential in a lot of ways. And the book talks about, you know, under medical care and sort of this idea of cleaning up, you know, before we hear the message. And to me, that was what I needed. But when I got to that place, I didn't want to stop drinking. By the time I left, I didn't want to go back to the same way of life that I've been living. And to me, that's the third tradition. That's, you know, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And that was my case. Is that I had that desire to stop drinking by the time I left that facility. It took a long time, you know. But, you know, and people that talked to me, people would come up and visit that place while I was there and talk about AA and the 12 steps, and it lit a fire inside of me that maybe there's something Maybe there's a life to be lived after I leave this place. And so 2003, I left, and one of the first person or people I called was the person I thought I hated the most, Cooper. And he asked me if I had a sponsor. I remember I went to my home group, which is still my home group today, and he said, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "No." And I could sense that he like wanted me to ask him, but there's been in some indoctrination of what I should, how I should choose a sponsor from this rehab. So he had like 2 years at the time, and that was not enough. You know, I needed a sponsor with some time, some experience, you know, to guide me, and he was not ready to guide me. And so I sensed that, but he also sensed that too, and I think he knew, you know, how this place worked because he had been there too. And he said, "Okay, I get it." He said, "But why don't you get my sponsor?" He said he came here with two trash bags, and now he's doing pretty well. That's all he had to say to me. I didn't know this guy. I didn't know who his sponsor was. But I remember picking up the phone, you know, down in the basement of my parents' house on 16th Street in D.C., and picking up the phone and calling this guy up and asking him to be my sponsor, and it was weird. Like, I had never even, like, talked to this guy, but I said, "Can you be my sponsor?" And he's still my sponsor today. And we were talking about it. I was like, I cannot imagine having another sponsor. Mm-hmm. So everybody, a lot of people are like, you got to find a sponsor who has what you want, you know, or you know, all this stuff. I didn't know a damn thing about my sponsor, you know, and anybody was better than the joker that came into AA, and it just happened to be the right thing. So, but I got into AA, and, you know, life, after this rehab facility, I was like, I want to have fun. You know, I'm 19 years old when I got here. I want to have fun. I want to live life. How do you do that sober? And the secondary piece was I knew I wanted to not drink, but I didn't really realize what I was dealing with. I didn't realize that I had alcoholism. And I would have raised my hand and said, "I'm Justin and I'm an alcoholic," but I didn't know what that meant. And so for the first couple of years in AA, it was have fun. It was go to events, dances, you know, everything. I mean, I was doing all that stuff, going to the beach, you know, just having a blast in AA. But what happened was, and, you know, Clancy talks about this, is this spring that begins to tighten. And what happened was that spring just started to tighten inside of me. I started feeling restless, irritable, and discontented, you know. And the problem was, is I was in AA, and I wasn't doing AA. You know, I was sitting around and looking at people, and I saluted the flag of difference all the time, you know. I'm just not going to be able to get this. All you people seem really happy, but I'm not going to be able to feel happy in my own skin. And I'm not going to be able to get this AA thing. And it was uncomfortable for a number of years in AA. And so I got to about 2.5 years sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd done a fourth and the fifth step with my sponsor, and then I call it the sixth and seventh step limbo, and it's not like the limbo where you're trying to get under the broomstick. It's like a layer of hell that I was living in, where I was just testing out my defects, you know, running my life into the ground sober, and what happened was I became so uncomfortable inside of my own skin that I realized, the thought came to me, if I don't do something different in AA, there's no way I'm going to stay here long term. There's no way. I cannot live this, living this uncomfortable for the rest of my life. There's just no way possible. And I went to my sponsor and I told him about this, and he said, "Well, it sounds like you need to get into the steps again. You know, sounds like you need to do the eighth and the ninth step, and start moving forward with this stuff." And so that's exactly what I did. And it wasn't fun. It wasn't easy. But what happened was it paid dividends. And during this time, like, my alcoholism kind of manifested itself in weird ways too. You know, I had weird breathing tics. Like I would breathe funny because I felt so uncomfortable. I thought that fumes from cars were going to get me struck drunk. Like, I mean, it was crazy. And so I'd be talking to somebody, and all of a sudden I'd start going, and start, like, these nervous tics. Just my head. Just the insanity that's going on inside of my head was making me nuts. And as soon as I started doing AA, all these things went away. I mean, I can't explain it, but it happened. And once in a while, if I get tired, they'll come back a little bit. So if I start breathing funny, it's because I'm probably tired. So I got into the eighth and the ninth step because that was the important piece of what I do in AA from to kind of move things forward. And I'll mention, you know, when I did the eighth step, I wrote the list, or the list kind of came from my you know, fourth step, but there was some more stuff added to it. And when I did the eighth step, you know, part of it's just writing the list, but then the other part of it, and the second part of it is, and became willing to make amends to them all. That's the kicker right there. And that was what it took for me to start, like, showing up for life, showing up for my parents, being a son where I hadn't been one previously, being a brother where I hadn't been one previously, being an employee, being a good member of AA. I mean, there's a lot of things that I was incapable of doing in sobriety and throughout my life. So I had to start doing those things on a consistent basis to become an amended person. And by that time I came to doing my ninth step, the direct amends with most of the people that were on that list, it was almost like a formality. It was almost like I was doing these things just because that's what the steps required me to do. The real meat and potatoes of those two steps really for me was in the second part of the eighth step, was changing how I had been behaving and trying to show up in new ways that I had never been able to before. I did have, and I'll share one of my really you know, powerful ninth step amends. And I mentioned my brother, you know, in the beginning of this. And so my brother, you know, he passed away when I was like 3.5 years old. I remember bits and pieces. Some of it might be just stuff that my parents had told me. But I remember little bits and pieces of him growing up. And, but when I got sober, I felt guilt and shame. I felt like, you know, if he had been alive, he'd probably been kicking my butt, you know, for how I'd been treating my mom and my family. And, it just might have been a different kind of atmosphere. And I felt bad. I felt like I had, you know, dishonored him and how I acted in my life. And so the only way to kind of try to make this right, my sponsor told me, was write a letter to him. Read it at his grave. Bring him up to speed about where your life is. And so that's what I did. And so I wrote this letter, and it just brought him up to speed. And I went out to the grave site. It's down in Richmond. When I got there, there had been a storm the night before, and some trees had been uprooted. And the caretakers were out in the cemetery. They said, "You can't come out here. There was a storm last night, yada, yada, yada. It's a liability." And at this point, I'm already, like, freaked out. I said, "God, am I not supposed to make this amends? You know, I'm talking to the sky. God, what's going on here?" You know, and they said, "You know, take it into the management office. They'll take the flowers out for you." I said, "Okay." Walked in the management office. My family, my grandparents, I think, had bought plots, a bunch of different plots, which scares me. I don't want to buy plots for myself. That seems like a setup. But they had bought some plots, and so my brother was next to my grandparents. And so I explained, I asked if they could look at my brother and tell me where he was at. Couldn't find him in the system. You know, they said management over the years has changed hands and this, that, and the other. I said, okay. I said, well, can you find my grandparents? And they found my grandparents, and he's right next to my grandparents. They still couldn't find him in the cemetery. And finally, the lady says, just go out there. It's fine. It's almost like she could sense that I was on a mission here. But to me, in my mind, I was like, another weird occurrence. Maybe, and I believe in this stuff nowadays, you know. Maybe it was my brother trying to let me know that he was there. And so I went out, you know, and prior to doing this, whenever you do some sort of amends like this, you imagine that it's going to be something like birds chirp. I mean, I imagine like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs when the birds come down and lift off, you know, the leaves and fly in and brush it away with their wings and, you know, and that it's magical. So I had all these preconceived notions of what it was going to be. But I wiped off his grave and I read this letter and just brought him up to speed. Nothing magical seemed to happen, okay? And then I'm finished with the letter, and I start walking away, and I get chills whenever I talk about this. And what happened was, at that moment as I'm walking away, I realized that I didn't want to leave my brother. I felt an overwhelming sense that he was there. I didn't want to leave my brother. And almost simultaneously with that thought and feeling, I realized that I never had to go back to drinking. The thought came in, you never have to go back to drinking ever again. And I also understood this is why the ninth step is so important. This is why this phase in our development is so important. It's because without that, that was the first time I'd really felt a strong connection with God. It's the first time I'd really felt like safe and protected is in that experience. You know, and I left that day, and I went and made direct amends to my mother. Same day, I was able to tell her about this experience, which I don't even know if it really kind of phased her as much as it phased. But I was blown away, and I remember I went back to my Saturday night meeting that I went to that night, and Mike, who you remember, Mike was there, and he came up to me, and I didn't talk to Mike too much, but he came up to me and he said, "You've changed." Without really talking, you know, to him much about what I'd just done, but he said, "You've changed," and you know, and from that experience, I continued to make amends, and my life transformed. You know, the stuff that it talks about in the promises, the you know, ninth step promises, that stuff started to happen in my life. I became comfortable in my own skin, and I was capable of functioning in this world and being a productive member of society. And not just being a constant taker. And, you know, the good and the bad. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that's happened, but there's a lot of, and I don't even look at things as bad anymore necessarily in some cases. I think just stuff happens. You know, I don't know what's bad and good. I mean, well, that's not true. I know what's good and bad. I know right and wrong, but I don't know what's good for me and what's, you know, bad for me sometimes. I'll tell you what, I don't know what's good for me because I think that, you know, I mean, I have a lot of great ideas. I think money will solve most problems. It doesn't. I have a theory that a lot of money, you know, it doesn't make you happy, but it'll make your misery more comfortable. But I graduated from school. Around this time, I met a girl, got married, and, you know, life seemed like all the outside stuff seemed to be working all right. And then constant fighting with the wife at the time, and, you know, it didn't end up working out. She left. She was in AA. She was in my home group. Whew, that's fun. I was devastated. Devastated in AA, sober, you know, felt like I was a failure, felt like things were just awful. Felt like I was ending up like my dad, who I thought like I'd never want to be like my dad in this category because he's on his third marriage now. Third one stuck. Knock on wood. But I didn't want to feel like that. I'd failed. And I really took those vows, you know, seriously. And And so, needless to say, she did me a favor. In fact, some of my friends have offered to send her thank you letters for doing that, because what it did was it launched me back in AA. And I was on the way out. I would say to myself, I'm a grown man. I don't have to go to these events. You know, I like had all these ideas about what I was becoming and what I, you know, this, that, and the other. And the problem is God's will, hindsight is 20/20. I only see God's will in the past. I don't see it while I'm in it. So the worst things in the world, seemingly worst things in the world, end up being, in a lot of cases, the best things that have ever happened to me. And so I got out of this, and likely this was one of the key reasons that I actually stuck around in AA, was because I wasn't in this marriage that was, you know, dwindling away, and I was now forced to become connected with AA a bit more. And luckily I had a good group of guys surrounding me, you know, that were carrying me. I mean, it seems like people have carried me in AA more than I have done for others, and I'm really grateful for that. And you know, and life is life. Things have ebbed and flowed. I've, you know, my sponsor at times, he likes to make me try out my own ideas as much as I can. And I thought that I could just spend money on credit cards and not really worry about paying them off. And he would say things to me. And I think he was trying to reverse psychology. He'd say, just max them out. Max out the credit cards. And I think he was hoping that I would be like, no, I'm not going to do that. No, I'm going to max them out. So I maxed out credit cards and got into massive amounts of debt and just, you know, tore up that side of my life. And I'm almost done paying all that off, which is nice. And then I met another girl in AA, you know, and she can deal with the good and the bad. So she knows what she's dealing with. You know, she's from Chicago originally, and so we, I guess it was 2 years ago. I had an idea. Maybe this is intuition. It might be. I got an idea to. She's a big Cubs fan, so I got an idea to propose to her on the scoreboard at the Cubs game that we were going to. We were going to 4th of July with her dad and her brother. Her whole family was there, so I did that, and I mean, it was unbelievable. I became a Cubs fan at that point, and everybody said that I was a bandwagon guy. They weren't on the train to the World Series. The next year, they made it to the World Series, so I'll take it. But you know what? Today, it's my life is unbelievable. I live way outside of my means. I'm still a lunatic. I mean, AA doesn't cure everything. It certainly helps with a lot, but I'm still a nutcase, and I can accept that. That's my humility, that I'm still not right completely. But I believe in AA and what it's done in my life. And last thing I'll say is, my stepdad recently had a seizure from alcohol withdrawal, and was in the ICU. Went to 30-day treatment facility, and down in Richmond, got out, and now he is he's sober like 90 days. You know, we had our first sober Atkinson Thanksgiving this past week. We took him to his home group. I mean, it was crazy. He's on fire for AA. I got him a cell phone. He's blind, so I got him a cell phone. Plugged in a sponsor's phone number in there for him, and tried to explain how many buttons he had to push in order to get to a sponsor. But it's like, I mean, life ebbs and flows, and it's a cool ride. But I think that's all I got. Grateful for AA. Grateful to be here. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you.